I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Welcome back everyone, thank you for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it so far. We long for responses and reviews and emails and messages on Twitter or Facebook, whatever you fear.
Yeah, please, please do. And I said I would remember our email for this week. bloodties.podcast@gmail.com.
I think that's right.
She said confidently.
Yes.
You'll find us on all social media as well though.
Yes, more than you'll find me. I'm not on any social media.
You could go on social media maybe, Dad. Have you thought about it?
I could, but I don't know.
Not sure?
I'm not all that sure. It's bad enough you get these strange emails from people because they can go through my website.
Those are just your fans, though.
Well, they're not all fans. I got a number of very angry ones.
Who have you been offending?
It's about a case which we will come to, about the killers of Fuselier Lee Rigby and Adebolajo. And I've had a number of, how can I put it politely, a pretty angry emails, people saying, why are you picking on Muslims? Well, they did make the point that it was, to some extent, a statement against the British military and that they were Muslim and they had been radicalised. But people are very sensitive about that kind of thing, and so...
It's difficult because of grouping and stereotyping, I think, that's a problem.
Well, one of the problems, especially doing anything that involves killing, is that you're inevitably, as we've talked about in this podcast, you're inevitably going to have some characteristics that follow. Now, that was a specific genesis from... radicalisation, but there are characteristics. A young man who starts fires and hurts animals is more likely to become a killer than one who doesn't. And there are those kinds of progressions. So I'm reluctant to do stereotypes, of course, but there are certain categories that inevitably fit in to what you might describe as a stereotype.
Yeah. I think that's true. How's your week been anyway? 2 weeks?
My 2 weeks have been fine. I've read a very, very interesting book.
Oh, yeah?
This is a true crime book. No, it's not crime fiction. It's written by a woman called Michelle McNamara, and it's about a rapist and killer in California who operated over a very long period of time. In the end...
A real person.
A real person who was never caught. She nicknamed him the Golden State Killer.
Although he's not the East Coast Rapist.
Not the East Coast Rapist.
Oh, a different guy.
Different guy. But the Golden State Killer is the East Bay Rapist. There are two different... It's a confusing picture. But McNamara, who had no real track record at all in true crime, she'd written a couple of television shows, became obsessed with every detail of the crimes, the victims, the places, and it's an extraordinary depiction, on the one hand, of his terrible deeds, and on the other, I suppose you would say the lighter side, of her utter fascination with him. She would sit up in the middle of the night, she would become, troll the internet, absolutely. And she tracked people down that you wouldn't even think of. And it was an absolute labour of love. And it is an astonishing book. But the even more astonishing thing about it was that she died at the age of 46. About a year and a bit before the book was finally published.
Oh, before she even saw it published.
She never saw it published. And in fact, it's been finished off. Some of the elements of it have been finished off using her notes by other people. It's very well edited. It's got a big reputation in the United States, and it's published here by Faber and Faber on the 1st of March. It is quite amazing, a book, genuinely impossible to put down. And it's so good because it's so unexpected. She doesn't do the obvious linear. She jumps about. She talks about how she got involved, how she got interested. And there are two things, two quotes I particularly admire. Stephen King. It's a journey into two minds, one sick and disordered, the other intelligent and determined. I loved this book. And Michael Connelly, the author of Harry Bosch and The Lincoln Lawyer. Michelle McNamara has not only successfully resuscitated the fascinating case of the Golden State Killer, but has done so with humanity, insight and grace. It is very good.
Sounds really excellent.
And what about you?
I find it so hard to remember what I've done, even though I do so many things.
Well, you go to the theatre.
Maybe that's why I find it so hard to remember the things. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to go and see The Brothers' Size this evening, which is like almost impossible to get a ticket to. Which is written by the same guy that wrote the film Moonlight. It's on at the Young Vic.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to that. It's got one of our clients in it, Anthony Welsh. Not one of my clients, but one of my company's clients. Other than that, I don't know.
Have you seen a movie? Have you seen them?
No, I didn't. I watched most of the reboot of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy on the weekend, which is really good, which is the show they rebooted on Netflix. Just an indication of how I work in the industry, but I don't actually do anything hugely related to work outside of it.
Well, I've nearly finished Fargo.
Nearly finished all three seasons of Fargo.
I do think the Ewan McGregor's performance in Series 3 is astonishing.
Was it worthy of him saying thank you to his wife and girlfriend at the same time when he won an award for it?
No, but that was much, you might describe as a severe misjudgment.
I mean, that is the illest judgment I've ever heard in my life.
But he does play two brothers who don't look at all alike each other. And
which brother do you think he should have won the award for?
I think the performance as a whole. It is a very considerable performance. As much as Billy Bob Thornton in the movie and the first series was astonishing. And this third series has another Fargo villain.
Don't you love Jesse Plemons and
yes.
Kirsten Dunst?
Of course.
Now they're together and they're having a baby. It's my best thing ever.
Yes. But the Series 3 of Fargo has an absolutely wonderful villain.
Played by?
I can never remember his name. He's very tall. He's got very bad teeth.
Let's Google him.
A comb over. He's kind of... But he's extremely menacing and almost kind of, ooh, you know, you went, oh my goodness. Ooh, he's the sort of man who tidies up crimes. It's very, very, very good. And I've got one episode left to watch, which I hope to do this evening.
I don't think I will be able to find him on here because I don't know. I'm not even close to knowing who
he is. Doesn't matter, darling, but I would recommend Series 3 of... The television series, Fargo.
Is David Thewlis in season 3?
David Thewlis, it is David Thewlis.
It's David Thewlis?
I think so.
You know David Thewlis, Daddy.
Yes, sorry, forgive me. My mind is not as quick as it once was.
Also, he's in Harry Potter, so...
Oh, I never watched
Plays
Harry
one
Potter.
Of my favourite characters in Harry Potter.
Yes.
I know you always did the, like, oh, I hate Harry Potter thing, but...
I like it. I hate Harry Potter.
I know, you don't hate it. You can't hate something you don't know.
I don't know. I can
you can choose
say,
not to engage with it, which
is
different.
I've chosen not to engage with it, you're quite right.
All right then, well, we won't waste any time as we're trying to be more succinct this year. So this week we are doing the Twilight Teenagers.
Yes, the Twilight Killers, they were also called. I think this is one of the most extraordinary and chilling cases. It only involves two murders, but it does involve some of the, among the youngest killers in British legal history. And the more you look at the case, and I've looked at it again recently in preparation for this podcast, the more haunting it becomes. In very simple terms, it all takes place in the town of Spalding in Lincolnshire, which is a strange sort of place. It's dissected by the River Welland. It's south of Boston, Lincolnshire. It is quite introverted, although in recent years it's been changed by migrant workers coming in to work in the tulip fields. And it is... You wouldn't describe it as an outward-looking place. Anyway, in a small semi-detached house, number 5 Dawson Avenue, in the just after midnight on a Wednesday night, the 13th of April 2016. Kim Edwards, a 14-year-old girl, and her boyfriend Lucas Markham, full name Stan Lucas Markham, also 14, contrived to kill Kim's mother, Elizabeth Edwards, 49-year-old, dinner lady, churchgoer, worked at the local primary school, and Kim's younger sister, Katie. Both were stabbed repeatedly. It was a crime that really didn't attract a lot of attention at the outset, because reporting restrictions remained in place. And so no one could report that, in fact, these killings had been carried out at the instigation and with the collaboration of the daughter of the family.
Because they were children.
They were children. And indeed, it wasn't until June last year that the Court of Appeal agreed that in the public interest, the identity of the two young people, who were by then 15, should be revealed. I think it caused the most enormous shock in the town of Spalding, but it was a truly horrifying case. So let's just do the outline first, and then I'll try and go into the backstory.
Okay.
Because the backstory is almost more interesting than the actual horrific crimes themselves.
Okay.
Mother, Elizabeth Edwards, the dinner lady, and elder daughter. There is actually another eldest daughter, but she isn't really anywhere in the
picture.
So
there are three daughters.
All together, but only two.
And in this instance.
In this particular house in Dawson Avenue.
Yeah.
It's a pair of semi-detached. There's a bit of a back garden. There's a bit of a shed. There's a sort of where you park your car and a bit of grass in front. But it's unprepossessing. Ordinary. There's no trees in the road, but it's perfectly ordinary. It's nothing threatening or frightening. There are no dark corners. At the end of the week of the 9th of April, on the 9th of April, the killings took place in the end of 13th, early 14th. Elizabeth Edwards has a tremendous argument with Kim Edwards, the daughter, about Lucas and the fact that he's not going to be allowed in the house, and he's bad influence, and he's been expelled from school, and everybody knows he's a bad boy, and I don't want you to be with him, and that's the end of that. And I'm not having him in the house again ever. Not surprisingly, the 14-year-old takes exception to this and storms off and barricades herself in Lucas's bedroom, because Lucas lives with his aunt.
Well, she leaves her
house.
She
leaves her house and goes to his house, about 30 minutes walk away.
Okay.
And they barricade themselves in the bedroom overnight until finally the aunt coaxes them out. They then go to the riverbank of the Welland, and discuss a plan to kill Elizabeth Edwards and Kim's sister Katie.
Why would they want to include the sister?
Well, so that she wouldn't have to put up with any more unpleasantness. That was Kim's. As this story extends, it becomes even more horrifying.
Okay.
They hatch a plan in McDonald's later that the following evening, the Monday, Lucas will walk to her house and late when everybody's gone to bed and knock on the window or make sound outside the window, and Kim will let him in through the bathroom window on the upstairs story, but he'll have to climb onto the roof of a shed. So Monday night he goes round, Kim's fast asleep. Tuesday night he goes round, she's still fast asleep. Wednesday night he goes round, and I love this, all ordinary domestic details are always so fascinating. This time she manages to stay awake. Lucas has come prepared. He's got a backpack, And inside it has got four kitchen knives. Two big ones, two smaller ones. Now, on a number of occasions, Lucas, the boy, has said to Kim, "Are you sure you want to go through with this?" And she said, "Yes." And when he gets inside the house, she opens the backpack, takes out the knives. It has to be assumed that she chose the one he should use, which is quite large. If you look at any of the websites, it's a big knife. But she doesn't do the killing. Originally, I think they decided that he would kill the mother because he was a boy and she would kill the sister, but it didn't quite work out that way. She has got her wits about her. She tells him at one point to take his shoes off as he's making too much noise and might wake them up, because by then mother and sister are both asleep.
Yeah.
The idea is to kill them while they're sleeping.
You'd have to do it at the same time because the other one will wake the other one up.
No, they thought about that. They decided that they should be stabbed in the voice box to prevent them making any noise.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
Yeah, it is. In one of the police interviews, one of the interrogators says, "Where did you get this idea?" And Kim Edwards says, in a very matter-of-fact voice, "Oh, just thought of it." So it's decided that the mother should be killed first. Lucas goes into the bedroom, starts to stab her. She struggles. I mean, she struggles for her life, quite rightly. I mean, I think he said later in court that she scratched his back, his face, his bum. You know, she was fighting for her life. But he's on top of her. He stabs her 8 times, twice in the neck, and finally smothers her. Now, Kim has arrived to watch this at the door. We're talking about a 14-year-old girl here. Arrives to watch this. She says at one point in a police interview, "I think I heard her say, 'Get off me,' but I'm not sure." I mean, in court, the prosecuting counsel said of her that she took about as much interest in the killing of her mother as she would have done a goldfish or a hamster. It was and was characterised in court as a cold, calculated and callous killing. Anyway, the mother is finally clearly dead. I think Lucas at one point said she went limp after 3 minutes. And so they turn their attention to the sister. It was, as I said, originally the plan that Kim should kill her sister, but in the end she couldn't do it and got Lucas to do it. He stabs her twice in the neck, killing her almost immediately. Katie's
thank
got
God.
No way. She's only 13. It's a slip of a thing. And so now you have two bodies in the upstairs room of the house. Kim's plan was that they should wash the blood off, because there's bound to be a lot of blood. So they should take a bath together. So they duly do take a bath together. They take a mattress into the living room. And now it's unclear at what order this came in, but it's blatantly apparent that they have sex. They've been having sex for about a year and a half, both the first partners, incidentally. And it's also worth saying, and it's a parenthesis, that their relationship was fraying at this point, but not fraying sufficiently for either of them to pull out. They watch Twilight movies, hence the nickname the Twilight Killers. They watch four. They eat ice cream and toasted tea cakes, and they stay there in the house downstairs for 36 hours.
Wow.
Lucas's aunt comes round. They refuse to answer the door. Eventually, and this is, remember, Wednesday night into Thursday morning, eventually, no, they don't turn up at school because they're in the same class, reported missing. Finally, at lunchtime on the Friday, the police break into the house through a front door, front window. Not the front, but they don't break the front door down like in one of those drug raids you see on television. They break a window and open a latch and get in. And discover Kim and Lucas in the living room.
Watching TV, eating ice cream.
And tea cakes. And they arrest them. The two bodies are upstairs and still upstairs.
They haven't done anything.
They haven't done anything to them. They're just dead.
So did they make a plan for that part, or did
they had a plan. Their original plan was to commit suicide after the killings. But I think...
That seemed harder.
That was probably... felt that was a bit harder. And indeed, I think at one point Kim... In fact, I know at one point she wrote a suicide note, which was quite rude, and said, "I want to be cremated and my ashes scattered in our special place," which was the riverbank. But that plan didn't quite work, and so they were arrested. Now, there's no doubt there were no other suspects in this case. Come on, skinny
love, just let's see you. See Bon Iver live at All Points East. Don't miss Bon Iver live Sunday the 2nd of June at Victoria Park, London. With special guests Mac DeMarco, First Aid Kid, John Grant, Ezra Furman and many more. Tickets available now at allpointseastfestival.com.
And originally, both pleaded not guilty to murder, but guilty to manslaughter, with the idea that they would plead when it came to the trial that they weren't capable of making a rational judgment. But it is fair to say that the interviews that Kim Edwards gave to the police are some of the most chilling I have ever had the opportunity to hear. You can find parts of them on the net, but she says things like, what's your explanation? And I quote, "I wanted to get a revenge for the way she treated me." This is on her mother. "I did it because I didn't like my mum at all, and I didn't want her to ruin or corrupt anyone else. I didn't feel anything for my mother. She deserved to die. I'm glad she's dead. Ever since I was young, I never got on with my mum. She always favoured my sister."
The younger one.
The younger one. "Oh, she used to tell me that she didn't, but I knew she was lying." Now, that is a very considerable thing for a 14-year-old to say. I mean, 14-year-old girls, yes, they're full of angst and the usual adolescent problems and all of that teenage rebellion, but this is quite careful. This is an explanation. "I'm glad she's dead" is an extraordinary thing for any daughter to say about her mother. I really believe that. And of course, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation later that lots of people say that, "Oh, I hate you, I'm going to get, I wish you were dead," and all that teenagers say to their parents all the time. But very, very few actually commit the crime.
Yeah.
And that's what, it's one of the many things that makes this case so interesting. They go eventually to trial in November, at Nottingham Crown Court, in November 2016. Lucas changes his plea and pleads guilty to murder.
Okay.
She maintains her plea that it's manslaughter, and she said that she wasn't capable, her defence said was, that she wasn't capable of making a rational judgment. Partly.
At what point?
At the point in which she encouraged the killing. In other words, the balance, the old phrase would be, the balance of her mind was unsound.
But you would get the sense from the beginning that he was the badly behaved one and she was the one being led astray, but it sounds quite a lot as if it may have been a bit the other way around, or if she was very manipulative or persuasive with him.
I think it's absolutely clear, and I think it was said, I know it was said in court, that she was the driver. She manipulated him rather than the other way around. He was the bad boy, he has no question. I think what first attracted him to her was that she was in a class and he was a real rebel, and he picked up a chair in the classroom and threw it at the teacher. And I think from that moment on, she thought, "Oh, he's the man for me." And when he heard that she liked him, he contacted her on Facebook, and there began what was later to be described as an intense but toxic relationship. She maintains at her trial that her ability to make rational judgments had been impaired. Psychiatrists are called on both sides. She was perfectly rational. No, she wasn't. She was perfectly rational. Anyway, the jury of 7 men and 5 women take less than 3 hours, 2.5 hours, to find her guilty. They are now among the youngest murderers of a double killing, particularly, in British legal history. But they can't be named. Indeed, their relationship to the victims cannot be uttered in open court. Although, of course, all the people who are in court know perfectly well who's in the dock, because Elizabeth Edwards' estranged husband is in court. Her current boyfriend is in court. The grandparents of Katie and Kim Edwards are in court. So everybody's perfectly well aware in court.
But you can't say anything.
It can't be reported. There were some very well done drawings by the court artists, only showing the backs of them, because it obviously their identities were protected. Indeed, it wasn't, as I said, until June 2017 that the Court of Appeal, led by Sir Brian Leveson, agreed that their names could be revealed. But what I think is interesting, and in a way even more chilling, not just the terrible nature of the crime and the fact it can be committed by two 14-year-olds, but it's the backstory. This horror story begins in 2008 when Kim Edwards is 6. Her mother hits her over an argument about the television set and refers herself to social services.
Her mum does?
Yes. Kim and her younger sister, 6 and 5, are put into care.
Did her mum have mental health issues?
No, I think she may have had anger issues.
Well, she just... Or if Kim was like a total nightmare.
Well,
not that I'm saying it's excusable, because I'm not, but if she was like pushed to a point where she reacted very badly to something and then she suffered terrible guilt,
the problems were, the family were reunited, but problems reoccurred again in 2013 when Kim's mother Elizabeth told her teachers that she was planning to run away.
Kim was going to run away.
In fact, she didn't, and things seemed to improve again. In January 2015, what I'm trying to do here is paint a picture. This was a dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
This wasn't a bolt from the blue murder.
No, understood.
You know, this wasn't... I know it's hard for people to understand that this kind of anger, this kind of rage of a young girl could have built up over so long, but in a way it had been. In January 2015... her mother finds a suicide note written by Kim. In May 2015, however, she first meets Lucas properly and the beginning of the relationship, which is called Bonnie and Clyde, but I don't think that's the right parallel. I really don't. By October 2015, Lucas and Kim run off and sleep rough in the woods north of Spalding for 6 nights until they're finally discovered.
That's quite a lot of nights to sleep rough.
This was the real intensity of the relationship, the first sexual relationship of both of them. This was a, how can I put it, phosphorus.
It was them against the world.
Yeah, them against the world. Well, inevitably, Elizabeth Edwards, dinner lady at the local primary school, started to put her foot down about Lucas. The arguments went on. I think at one point one member of the family described this couple of young people as a time bomb waiting to go off. And Kim herself said of it, "My life was a living, walking hell." In March 2016, the month before the murders, Kim takes an overdose of painkillers, but doesn't succeed. She's in hospital for 2 nights, but doesn't succeed in killing herself. So what I'm trying to do is give you a sense that this was not, you know, I think sometimes people see murder as a sudden, unexpected, dramatic event. That what you might describe as the domestic abuse kind of.
Well, that's a more crime of passion type thing,
yes,
isn't it?
But this one was a disintegration of a family over a long period of time.
And so it sounds like you feel that weighs far more on Kim than on Lucas. Lucas just happened to be a kind of suitable companion for her.
Yeah, Lucas had the misfortune of his mother dying when he was the age of six. She got leukemia. He and his two brothers were brought up by the aunt. And he was obviously a very naughty boy. I mean, he was a bad boy.
No more than
lots of others.
Yeah.
And I think that plays to the point, as I said earlier, that he keeps on saying to her, you know, are you sure you want to go through with this?
Mm.
And she could have said at any point, and indeed even on the night of the murder, she could have said, no, let's not.
Yeah.
And he could have crept back out the bathroom window, which is the way he got in.
But then also, she didn't wake up the first two nights and he kept going back.
Yeah.
But was that because of her and her being?
I think it's... There must have been at least a partly sexual motive to it.
Yeah.
But there is no doubt in my mind that this terrible murder had grown over a period of years, festering in the family. And all this anger that she talks about, that Kim talks about in her police interviews, you know, this is not, how can I put it, this is not a one-off. This is not a sudden feeling. This is an absolute vengeance. And I think at one point she tried to explain it, the killing. She said to the police, well, it meant that my mum doesn't have to deal with me anymore. She doesn't have to wake up in the morning and worry if I'm dead. And my sister doesn't have to deal with me. The reason for killing both of them. Now, you could call that distorted reality or an extraordinary lack of compassion, but in her phraseology, in her mind...
Yeah, well, I suppose if you haven't managed to kill yourself and you feel like you're a burden on the other people, getting rid of the other people is another way around it.
It's another way around it. And I think at one point in the summing up, the prosecution used a very telling phrase. They said, brutality and contempt oozes from every pore of this girl. And it's very hard to disagree with that conclusion. It is significant that the relationship between the two collapsed almost immediately on their arrest.
Obviously.
This is not Hindley and Brady.
Oh, right. No, there isn't.
This is not...
But it's not a shared...
This also, is not an enduring passion.
Also, it's the woman in control rather than the man.
Yes.
Not like the man wants to kill and he's got a subservient woman with him.
Although, of course, one of the most chilling aspects of the Moore's murders were the one murder when she killed to prove to Brady that she loved him.
Yeah, I know, but that was still for him.
Oh, it was still
for him.
Whereas
this is very much for her.
This is for her. At the point, again, one of the psychiatrists at the trial made the point, and I don't think I believe him, but nevertheless it's worth saying, and I quote, if they had not had this intense toxic relationship, this would never have happened. It is the relationship that is behind the killings. I don't think so. I think that's simplistic. I think it doesn't include the family history and what had gone on between the mother and daughter over a long period of time, over 8 years.
She probably wouldn't have been able to kill them, though.
No, that's true. She wouldn't have been able to kill.
But that doesn't mean that it would have to be Lucas. It could have been anyone. Like, if it hadn't have happened, then potentially it could have happened at any point further down the line.
Indeed, indeed. But there are very, very few female killers.
And true.
And it is a very rare... We've talked about Joanna Dennehy, but these are exceptions. They're by no means the rule.
Definitely.
And this is also not, to my mind, Fred and Rose West. This is... And so it's not, for me, what's known as folie à deux, the conjunction of two people makes a worse crime than there being only one. This is a horrible... connection of circumstances that the manipulative woman finds a man who's willing to be manipulated and is also brutal.
Yeah.
A boy, I should say. Sorry, a manipulative girl finds a boy is prepared to be brutal. I think it is because it's so exceptional. It's one of the very, very few. I think at one point it's described as, this is almost without precedent. I think the CPS at one point described it as almost without precedent. And that's why it is, I think, tremendously chilling. It's not just staying in the house with the bodies. It's not just eating tea cakes and watching Twilight movies. It's not just having ice cream. It's not just, it's just the whole dreadful reality of planning the murder of your mother and your sister, finding a willing person to do it for you, and it is a truly horrific crime. And what makes it so telling is it's so unusual.
And why did they decide to release the names?
The argument was that the Court of Appeal, originally the trial judge didn't lift the reporting restrictions back in November 2016 when the jury discovered, found her guilty. He sentenced them originally to 20 years each, but that was reduced by the Court of Appeal to 17 and a half years each. And he ordered that their names could be released in the public interest. Otherwise, how could the public understand what had gone on in Dawson Avenue in Balding?
So they're both...
They went to the Court of Appeal. Their lawyers, the two young people's lawyers, went to the Court of Appeal to try and prevent...
The names being released.
You can imagine the argument, Venables and Thompson, we can't do it. In the end, three High Court of Appeal judges came to the conclusion that it was in the public interest because it made no sense. The public had a right to know what was going on here, even though they were only 14. At that point, they were by that time 15. But it is a remarkable case.
Yeah, I've never heard of anything like... Well, I mean, the kids who kill thing is...
I don't know. I mean, it's a bit eerie, and I'm not being against Spalding, but 2 months later, outside a sports centre, a man killed his wife and daughter with a shotgun, then killed himself, also in Spalding.
Maybe it's not the easiest place to live or grow up.
Maybe. But, that was much more domestic. Mother and daughter had just moved out of the house, and he was very angry and decided he was going to...
Economic circumstance, maybe.
Yeah.
Et cetera.
I do think it makes... because it's so fresh.
What do you think, then? Do you think their name should have been released?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I don't think
it... Do you think they're in prison for long enough?
Well, crikey.
Did they even...
17 and a half years is more than their life so far.
True.
You know, they'll be 16 this year.
They've got a chance for rehabilitation, I suppose.
Yes.
Do they go into normal prisons, or do they go into juveniles?
Juvenile, yes.
Until they...
Young persons, until they've come to 18, yes. But they have, they'll be kept entirely separately.
I know they... Do they have co-ed prisons? They don't, do they? No. Jeffrey's looking at me like I'm mad.
No, not at all.
In America, they do have some co-ed prisons.
They do, but we don't in this country.
Oh.
But I think it's a really fascinating case.
Yeah. Contemporary, as you said. Okay, there you go, guys. The Twilight Killers or Twilight Teenagers. Talk about something more fun.
Yes, a little bit. Anything's got to be
anything
more
lighter.
a little lighter than that, that's for sure.
You doing anything nice for Valentine's Day?
There's a dinner in Tatchbrook Street.
Yes, you're having that nice dinner. That'd be nice.
Otherwise, no, this week is made up with... I've got some notes back from ladies helping me with my novel, which are very positive.
Good.
So I've got... That's going to start on that. And I'm in the middle of some reviewing sequence. And to be honest, I've tried to have a couple of quieter weeks.
You have been very busy.
I seem to have been busy. And I've got my series on World's Most Evil Killers.
Oh, yeah. We need to plug your series.
It's on Sky Living at 9 o'clock on Sunday the 18th. And for the next 10 Sundays... at 9 o'clock on Sky Living, and repeated on Sky Pick.
What's it called?
It's called The World's Most Evil Killers.
Look out for it, guys.
And includes A lot of me talking about all kinds of...
Some people we've covered and some we haven't.
Yes.
And some we will.
And some we will. But it certainly includes Mark Bridger.
Oh, yeah, it does.
And includes Mick Philpott, the man who killed five of his family by...
Oh, we haven't done
burning
that.
The house down. It's a cheery viewing. Amazingly, people, and I was saying this to you before, I have several friends who send me emails saying, I saw you on this most dreadful program.
Lots of people see you on that program, yeah. On these programs.
Yes. That's.
I'm off to Berlin.
Oh, that'd be great.
Should be good.
I'm going to Broadstairs. Doesn't compare to Berlin, really.
A bit different, but it'll be equally fun. And I've totally forgotten to write down who we're doing next week, so it will be in 2 weeks, so it will just be a surprise.
Yes, it'll be a great surprise, probably to me as well.
From all of us. All right, well, thanks, Dad.
Pleasure, Molly.
And we'll see you soon.
Thank you, everyone.